stand in front of, you get propelled by it, and I think people will be knocked out by this concert.
There was a great story I heard about trumpet players having to play so high in the Stan Kenton band, they actually blacked out.
Oh, well, you know.
Will there be any of that tonight?
I hope not. They'll fall right off. I haven't got my band days with me. Actually, I've been looking at the trumpets at rehearsal, and they're all fantastic. Derek Watkins, of course, famous throughout the world, and I thought he was going to take off at one point. He'd filled up with so much air. A lot of them are doing circular breathing. I mean, it's quite challenging. So let's wait and see.
So what,
I hope not.
Well, yes, I'm going to say dropping like flies behind you on the stage. Now, listen, what's going to be a highlight for you tonight? What song should we be really listening out for?
Well, I think... Oh, that's a good question. I mean, I'm a great fan of all the singers that sang with Stan Kenton, which is how I got to know his work, primarily Anita O'Day and June Christie, and later on Chris Connor. And I'm going to sing Black Coffee tonight, and I've always loved that song.
Wow.
And there's also a fantastic arrangement by Marty Paish of My Old Flame, which I've loved for years. And I'm just going to sing that with the piano.
So that'll be fantastic.
I'm looking forward to doing that.
What an atmosphere it's going to be in here tonight. Listen, thank you so much.
Very welcome.
I'll let you get back with getting ready, getting your lipstick on.
More makeup.
Thank you so much, though. Well, I'm staying for that. Are you going to stay for that as well, Anthony?
No.
Can't manage that one? Oh, that's a shame. That's a shame. Now, listen, let's just go back half an hour or so, a bit more than that, 45 minutes, to the bridge, to the boat whistle. And to this fact that tonight we're really hearing a prom which focuses on very different aspects of British music. And we've got Holst coming up too.
Mm.
It is fascinating, isn't it, how different these styles of music are.
And yet people say that they think they all sound English to some extent. And then they go on to say, what is it about it that makes it sound English? And to be honest, I don't know. Because English composers have always been fairly eclectic. I mean, Elgar, for instance, the epitome of Englishness, people would say, gets his style from Schumann, Brahms, Wagner, even a little bit of Delibes. If you compare Sylvia with one of the Pomp and Circumstance marches, you might think they were both by the same composer for about 20 bars. So what is it about this Englishness? And there's Vaughan Williams. You can see he gets his music, to some extent at the beginning, from Tudor church music, from folk song, obviously enough, and a fair bit from Parry in his earlier pieces. But then he makes it into something which is entirely his own. I think the thing is, we then sort of learn to love it, and we think that he's an Englishman, so there must be something intrinsically English about his music. But it's very difficult to actually pin it down, I have to say.
Well, let's look ahead now to Holst's great work that we're going to hear in the second half of this prom, The Planets. An Englishman again, and a very popular, very well-known work. But where would you say his influences come from?
Well, again, he and VW were intimately connected with the English folk song movement. But Holst himself was very interested in what was going on abroad. You can hear Stravinsky, early Stravinsky, the Stravinsky of, say, Petrushka, and maybe the Firebird, in The Planets. And most odd of all, and I don't know how many people have perhaps picked up on this, I think you can hear a bit of Schoenberg in it as well. Yeah. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if Schoenberg hadn't been at that famous premiere of the Schoenberg Five Orchestral Pieces, which Henry Wood gave before the war, because I'm sure that there's a little bit of Farben from the Schoenberg in The Last of the Planets, in Neptune. The way it's put together and the sound world of it, I think, shows that he knew a little bit of his Schoenberg and had been fascinated by it, which I think some Holstians might be rather shocked by.
We're going to hear our conductor tonight, David Robertson, talking a little bit about the impact that this piece has. There's no question that even now, after what, 90 years, it still packs a punch when you hear it.
Oh, my goodness, yes. I mean, it's a really powerful piece and has great originality. Trouble is that we know it almost too well. It takes an effort of imagination to hear it as for the first time, but it must have made a hell of an effect on the first audiences. Nothing like it in the world of music before, and not much that's followed after, to be honest.
Why was it so radical at the time? Why was it so radical at the time, Tony?
Well, for those reasons which I mentioned just now, it related to other radical composers. It was just new. I mean, you don't hear anything quite like that in Vaughan Williams, for instance. No, it's a he's something of a mystic, and is a real original, and he forged a language. And of course, that language then gets related to by composers that come after, and you find it becomes part of an English tradition. But whether there's anything intrinsically English in it, apart from the melodic lines, which do relate slightly maybe to folk songs, like the famous I Vow to Thee My Country, which is actually the middle section of Jupiter, that sounds inordinately English to us today. Perhaps you can relate it to folk song, but it's just wholesome melody and it's become part of our way of life almost.
Well, Anthony Payne, it's been fascinating talking to you. Thank you so much for joining me here for this live interval. The BBC Symphony Orchestra are back on stage, so we're going to have to call it time for now. But it's time for the second half of tonight's prom. And as we've been saying, the perennial favourite, Holst's The Planets, is next. A piece which still has an enormous impact now. It certainly did when it was first heard just after the end of the First World War in 1919. Here's conductor David Robertson.
It's hard to go back and imagine what it was like when people first heard the whole overall conception, both musically and in orchestral colors, of The Planets. It's one that's hard for us today because so many Hollywood composers have used it with great success in many different films, and so in a sense, we're all familiar with the sounds, and yet it's here that is their real source. There's always a moment in Saturn where, especially with American orchestras, they tend to play it like John Williams, and it sounds, you want to be like Jonathan Rhys-Davies and say, Indy, look out! Just at this moment, because that's what it's sounding like, and you need to sort of come back to the real initial idea of the piece, which is this one in which not only are the planets these wandering objects in the sky that fascinate us, but also they represent various aspects of human characteristics. And these are just as pertinent nowadays as they were at the time.
David Robertson, tonight's conductor and impressionist as well in that interview. There are seven movements to expect in The Planets. First, we have Mars, the bringer of war, Venus, the bringer of peace, Mercury, the winged messenger, Jupiter, the bringer of jollity, Saturn, the bringer of old age, Uranus, the magician, and Neptune, the mystic. Well, the orchestra have tuned up. The lead, Andrew Havron, is on the stage. And the orchestra will be joined off stage by the women's voices of the Holst singers. So listen out for them. And all will be conducted by the orchestra's principal guest conductor, David Robertson, who we just heard just a few seconds ago. He's making his way to the stage any moment now to conduct Gustav Holst's The Planets.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
the magical ending to Holst's The Planets, performed by the BBC Symphony Orchestra and conducted by David Robertson. Earlier, he described that ending to me as a meditation on the universe and all of us in it, a reminder that we are all just tiny specks of stardust. I think the hair on the back of 5,000 necks stood up when the offstage voices of the Holst singers started to sing at the end there. The conductor now bringing each section to their feet, the percussion. Now the brass. Harps and Celeste. Now the woodwind. And finally, the entire string section. Wonderful reaction here in the Royal Albert Hall to the BBC Symphony Orchestra, the Holst singers, their chorus master is Simon Wookie, and to the conductor tonight, David Robertson. But that is it for the first of tonight's proms. Do tune in again, though, at 10:15 for the late night prom with the BBC Big Band and Claire Martin. I'll be back here in the Royal Albert Hall on Saturday for the grand finale to the season on BBC One and BBC Two. But now, I hope you've enjoyed tonight's prom. It is time, though, to hand you back to Broadcasting House and Jonathan Swain.
Katie Derham there at the Royal Albert Hall. And just to say, there's another chance to hear tonight's prom here on BBC Radio 3. Tonight's first prom, that is, here on BBC Radio 3 on Sunday afternoon, this coming Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock. Well, as Katie said, we're back live at the Hall at 10:15 for that Stan Kenton tribute. Before then, a Music Matters interview with Thomas Addis. That's in about 5 minutes' time. Until then, well, as tonight's prom finished with Holst's unaccompanied voices fading into the ether, this is Holst, unaccompanied voices, and a little more of the ether. The Evening Watch. It's an 8-part motet setting a dialogue by Henry Vaughan between the body and the soul, parting at the moment of death. Holst asks for a serene, sustained pianissimo until the last bars, when the choral sound expands into a blaze of fervour to illuminate the closing words. Yet this take with thee, the last gasp of time is thy first breath and man's eternal prime.
Thank you.
Paul Spicer directing the Finzi Singers. The soloists were alto Susanna Spicer and tenor Mark Milhofer. And that was The Evening Watch, a poem by Henry Vaughan, set to music in 1924 by Gustav Holst. This is BBC Radio 3. It's 19 minutes past nine. And time now for the second in a series of special Music Matters programmes, where Tom Service meets some of Britain's most important composers. This evening, in a programme first broadcast last year, Tom spends time with a composer who rarely gives interviews.
Thomas Addis, the most successful British composer of his generation.
It's a compulsion, you know, you can't not do it. That's the really important point. You know, what else would I do?
In an exclusive interview, you can hear him talk for the first time at length about his life and his music.
What is a piece of music? It's not actually an object, you can't hold it. But it is also a form which you could open a door, step into it, like a vehicle, and it would take you somewhere else.
This is music from a unique imagination. For me, it's powerfully direct, somehow timeless, but profoundly modern.
I didn't like Mozart especially at that point. Too saccharine for me. But it might be literally because I once ate a whole tub of ice cream while watching Zeffirelli's Marriage of Figaro on the telly. It was too much ice cream, too much Mozart.
Sometime in the mid-1990s, I put on a CD by Addis, who I'd only heard of at that stage through the hype of the classical music record industry. I stuck it on, and the first thing I heard was this. It felt to me like a sound I'd never heard the piano make before. Was Thomas Addis's Darkness Visible, a piece he composed in 1992, at the age of just 21, which he describes as an explosion of a John Dowland lute song. It's music that liquefies the sound of the piano into a shimmering sonic spectre. And I found the same imagination in the other pieces on the disc, the sensuality of Life Story, the ethereal brilliance of Traced Overhead, another solo piano work. The hype had nothing to do with it. Here was a music that spoke directly and powerfully on its own terms. Then there was an opera, Powder Her Face, written in 1995, which has become probably the most famous chamber opera of the late 20th century, and certainly the most performed. Later landmarks include Addis's first large-scale orchestral work, Asyla, from 1997, and in 2004 came his opera, The Tempest. Still only 39, Addis is also a virtuosic pianist, a conductor who's worked with orchestras from Los Angeles to London. He conducts the London Symphony Orchestra at the Barbican Centre in London on the 6th of June. And he was also artistic director of the Olber Festival for 10 seasons. Addis rarely gives radio interviews, so the next three quarters of an hour is your chance, our chance, to discover just how his musical imagination works. I wanted to find out, or to try to, why he writes his music, how he realises his musical dreams. At times, it felt a bit like searching for that elusive gold at the end of the rainbow. I met Thomas Addis at the offices of his publishers, Faber Music, in his hometown, London, and began at the beginning.
I can certainly remember spending a lot of time ransacking my parents' record collection. There was a particular box set of classics with rather an odd selection of things, which I liked listening to, like a, you know, one of those big boxes of different records.
Like a Reader's Digest box or something?
Well, it wouldn't have been exactly that, but it's something along those lines. But then there were things, yes, there were maybe, I think that we had cassettes in the car of Schubert songs, I remember, and the octet. Quite a lot of Schubert around, I think. So that was quite early on. And I think I did, as some children, very, you know, young children, I could definitely tell the difference between classical music on the radio, let's say, for the sake of argument, Mozart or something, and jazz. And I apparently was always not interested in the jazz. Presumably I couldn't understand it, but I still can't.
But the point is, you weren't consciously composing then, Tom, at this stage. You weren't thinking...
Well, okay, so there... Oh, yes, how do you know? There was a record of Chopin Polonaises, which I think that was the first classical music that I remember really excited me. I kind of got very, very excited by it, like physically excited, you know. And I wanted to learn how to play it. And I think the first piece that I wrote down was a tune that I'd sort of found on the piano. I was very, very, very proud of it. And it was very evocative to me of memories of the mountain walking or whatever. And a bit later on, I realised that it was the middle section of Chopin's first Polonaise that I simply remembered and then written down.
Which you thought was your own, though?
I did, yes. Sadly, it was not my own.
Which mountains did it remind you of? There was some particular memory you were trying, the music.
Should I be creepy and say the Tatras?
Was it true?
No.
Did you decide then to say, I'm going to be a musician? Was that ever a conscious decision?
No. But there was nothing else I could particularly do. And it was thought that it would be a good idea for me to start to learn. I said, I don't want to learn the piano. And then maybe I was asked, well, what do you want to learn? And I sort of plucked out of the air the idea of the violin. So I was probably the least successful violin student in the history of the world. Couldn't make the thing work at all. And then I agreed to learn the piano properly. But I never imagined I would be a pianist professionally. It didn't really cross my mind.
Did you imagine you'd be a composer at that stage?
I think so. I had a sort of feeling that that would be quite a cool thing. I definitely around... Yes, it is around that time. I wrote a piano piece. I was a fan of Eliot's poetry.
What was the piece then?
So I wrote a fantasy for piano based on The Wasteland. I remember there was a bit where you had to scrape pencils up and down the keys because it was something to do with the rats scuttling on. I also completed the first stanza, you know, the first block of the setting for chorus, orchestra and 30 percussionists.
30 percussionists?
Yes, yes.
The first stanza of The Wasteland?
Yeah, and I spent so much time working out all the instruments they'd play that I didn't get very much further than that. It's there, so I don't know.
These pieces are unperformed, I take it.
I hope I've thrown it away.
What was it, though, about Eliot's poetry that you obviously had some absolutely intuitive reaction to it. And I mean, what was it in The Wasteland that resonated with you?
Just the words.
No, but did it
I don't know. The mood was so fantastically powerful, but also the four quartets. I thought were just so beautiful. It's exactly the kind of thing you're thinking about when you're 13 or 14, actually. There's so much in the poems about time and memory, and I meant to write settings of these things called landscapes, and I just thought, I am going to do it now. I'm going to do all five of them, and I started on the top note and just I went from there.
And that was your
opus one. Ha ha.
Did you call it opus one before you'd finished the piece, if you see what I mean?
That would be a bit pompous, wouldn't it? But
well,
I can't remember.
Did you do it?
I had a sort of sense of it being okay, let's try this. I mean, let's really see if I can compose a piece properly. By that time, I vaguely decided something or other, I think.
Decided what? Decided that.
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, I wasn't going to suddenly turn around and decide to become a lawyer or something at that point. It would just be, the doors were pretty much closed of doing anything apart from working in music in some form.
It's funny, because you haven't said up to now that this was the thing that you really loved doing more than anything else. It's just that it was the thing you could do.
That's the way of saying it, is, yes. Well, that's an interesting point. I mean, it was the only thing I was any good at, and more importantly, it's a compulsion. You know, you can't not do it. That's the really important point. You know, you have some idea or whatever it is, form inside you, and you have to try to recreate it as exactly as best as possibly can. So that's more of a compulsion. You know, loved it.
But that's the one thing you've never questioned in a way, is that inner compulsion.
What else would I do, Tom? I mean, why would I want to do anything else?
Well, I don't know.
I was quite surprised, though, when later on people would show interest in the work that I'd done. And I remember finding it quite surprising, because I didn't know what I was doing.
The first time that really happened was at Cambridge, when you were a student at Cambridge, wasn't it, where there was public recognition happened?
About five people.
but actually at Cambridge what happened is that the place we are now, Faber Music, got wind of you and signed you up on the spot after hearing the Chamber Symphony, roughly.
Not quite.
But the point is that unusually as a student your music became part of a public discourse in a way that for many 19-year-old composers that didn't happen.
It was a nightmare. I mean, can you imagine? I mean, it was in some ways a terrible thing to happen. I would love to have gone off, and I'm not complaining for a moment about what happened in that sense, and being published or anything like that. But in terms of very, very early efforts to kind of use one's muscles as a fledgling composer, and you could quite easily fall out of the nest and splat. You know, when I say it's a bit of a nightmare if you're kind of 21 and that happens, it's quite different to sit there and put a note on paper knowing that it's going to be published than it is to not. I mean, I'm used to it now, but then it was really sort of terrifying. I mean, I was stymied for a bit, actually.
The thing about being published is the idea of being made public. Okay, that's a difficult process, but Tom, who were you learning from? Were you learning from your nominal composition teacher, Alexander Gurr? Were you learning from the music you were listening to, or were you simply learning from your inner compulsion to get these pieces that you had inside you out?
The third one.
Getting your own pieces out, in other words.
Much more, I think, yes.
More than being taught by anyone, than listening to
music. I mean, it's much more powerful what the experience is that you have inside when you react, and then that's how you learn. I mean, with due respect, my teacher in Cambridge, a very fine composer, but I think that we both knew it was just a sort of for the dotted line, really.
I wonder, though, if this isn't part of a sort of mythology that we all need, in a sense. Basically, it sounds like you were completely existing as a sort of egg of yourself, and that you were self-taught as a composer, the only thing you needed to listen to was inside yourself. But that can't possibly have been true. I mean, that must be true at the creative impulse.
No, wait a minute. I was in a place with the most fantastically complete libraries, so I was absorbing huge amounts of music, and I used to go to the proms. I used to spend the whole summer there. And I was voracious. I wanted to hear everything I possibly could. You know, that's the age when that should happen.
How did you navigate yourself then? I mean, did you have very conscious prejudices, pro and contra certain composers, ideas in music? What were they?
Oh, God. I suppose I was particularly fascinated by very obvious things, big pieces like The Rite of Spring, which I hated the first time I heard it. I just thought the ending was predictable. Can you imagine? But it was just one of those reactions you have of when you're kind of, you think you're so clever and you hear this thing. It's just sort of, I was also studying percussion, so I had a little battery of instruments, and I used to play percussion parts of things like Histoire du Soldat and Façade, and Beethoven always, but I didn't like Mozart especially at that point.
Why not? Do you like him now?
I just didn't like it.
Do you like it now?
Not much.
What are the things that you don't like about Mozart?
Too saccharine for me. It was just a taste. I didn't like the taste. But it might be literally because I once ate a whole tub of ice cream while watching Zeffirelli's Marriage of Figaro on the telly. It was a very pink chemical ice cream of some kind. It was too much ice cream, too much Mozart. Really.
So that's what you still think about Mozart? He's still too saccharine?
But that piece, I mean, I know perfectly well that there's much more to it than that. And in his tragic mode, I'm very happy, as it were, with Mozart. And also the pieces that sound happy and actually aren't, like the last piano concerto. I mean, I'm very happy with that. Thank you.
the decisions you made as a composer on the face of it, as a young composer, were very different to a lot of decisions that people of your generation would have made. I'm thinking of a piece like Sonata da Caccia, for example, which is a piece that's written for harpsichord, for baroque oboe, or oboe, and horn, and which makes quite conscious, deliberate reference to Couperin particularly. I mean, that, if you like, is in a way the exact opposite from what would be expected of a composer just writing something, if you like, is in a kind of modernist tradition in a way. So what you were doing was almost deliberately abstruse, right? It was deliberately to say, I am not like other composers, this is the kind of thing I'm doing.
Well, I think that was a result of a sense that I might be about to be boxed in by a certain kind of packaging and expectation or whatever. And I thought, well, I can literally sidestep the entire process by doing this piece that will make a point, that point, in another way.
Just tell us what the elements of that package were.
You're it still 22. Happens now. I was aware there was a danger of only being heard on the surface. You know, the sort of, my music sounded modern, therefore it would be commercially useful one way or another. And I felt that was too superficial. So I wanted to write a piece where you could hear the music and the surface at the same time.
What does that mean?
Well, you know, a lot of the time when you sit in a concert hall and when you're hearing music at all, there are several different things happening at once. There are several different times happening at once, and in fact places. I mean, you shunt between them, between being you sitting in this hall and there's this one person or 200 on the stage doing something, playing or singing. But at the same time, there's this other thing happening, which is a form in air, which is forming in your head, and you hear it. So you can close your eyes or open your eyes and step into this.
The piece of music, in
yes,
other words,
the
right?
piece
That's
of
what
music.
You mean.
Yeah. What is a piece of music? It's not actually an object. You can't hold it. I mean, it's not there at all once it's gone. But it is also a form. In other words, it's like an architectural form.
It has a shape.
Which you could step into, open a door, step into it like a vehicle, and it would take you somewhere else. You're shunting between those different realities and also the musical time, whatever it may be. I mean, of course, the piece is going to last a certain number of minutes and seconds, but that in some ways is completely neither here nor there. The power of a piece can be nothing to do with its length. So that's just the way I sort of am.
So it means in order to make people inhabit or get into the vehicle of the piece that you're writing, you want them to get past the surface of what the sound is, and that involves doing things differently from essentially from what you're expected to do. So, and that goes for something for Sonata da Caccia, this early piece, or it goes for Tevot, the recent orchestral piece, or Asyla, another orchestral piece. That's what you're always doing, trying to sort of go, to use a phrase that you sometimes use, a night move away from what people might expect to make people feel the form.
I want them to be aware of that shunting, of that difference between where they're sitting, you know, in their seat, and the people on the stage, and 7:30 and the Royal Festival Hall and all that stuff. Reality, if you like. The difference between that and what is actually happening in the air around them, which is the music. And not just the music as in, but the piece of music, the idea,
shape.
The big shape, yes, or the sequence of big shapes, which should be really like an entire, not just one door, but many doors that open from each other. I feel that's the most universal experience of music, which is being at a concert and being bored and your mind wandering. That's what's happening. Or being transported, of course.
This is Tevot, a piece he wrote 3 years ago for Sir Simon Rattle and the Berlin Philharmonic, a work he described to me at the time he wrote it as being about something rather colossal, the idea of the Earth carrying us all in safety through the cosmos.
Thank you.
what you're talking about there is the musical experience. You're talking about that same possibility being activated in a Beethoven symphony.
How do you think a Beethoven symphony was written? I mean, this form is there to be created, and it was created by somebody, and then it's recreated in front of us. So then again something is happening in time, which is very strange. I mean, that is close to visual art, in that if you're standing in front of a painting that was painted in, 1580, you're standing in the place where the artist stood, exactly in that place in relation to the painting, but a long time later. But then the time kind of then, in some ways, can collapse. It's a peculiar... When you have a piece of music, it's no longer an antique. It's not an antique object. It's a live thing that's happening in front of you. So I think that when you're composing, you enter that space, which should be, ideally, a space which is not fixed by time. It shouldn't want a date or... And I think if one's lucky and works carefully or whatever, you get to a point when you might be able to recapture some of that.
That's Tevot. But 10 years earlier, there was Asyla, a typical Ades title that, playing on the two meanings of the word asylum, a place of sanctuary, but also a place of madness. So how does Ades connect his internal idea of what a piece is with what it ends up sounding like? What's it like, in other words, to try and get these creative ideas out?
One enters a maze of some kind, and you have to find the way out. You have to find your way out of a problem. You compose in order to solve some problem, so you might not really know what the solution is until you get to the end. And then, but you find in the course of it that your trail, if you like, that you've left, your footprint is the piece, and perhaps the shape of that particular maze.
So that the piece is...
You have an idea which requires an answer, and then that requires another answer, and the whole thing, you're in deep, and you have to get out. It's really like getting out of quicksand or something, or whatever it is.
Okay, what is the problem in a sign?
The problem is the melody, you write a melody, and that in itself creates an instability which needs to be resolved.
The melody at the start of a song.
Well, for example, yes. I think that was the first thing to be written. The piece is a result of that melody, really. So what you have in that melody, that it has a kind of twist in it, and that creates the conditions for, it's the butterfly wing, is it called? I don't know.
Chaos theory, that something, a butterfly flaps its wings.
That's a little bit how a piece might be born.
Right, so it's the idea of the melody, the horn melody at the start of a Asyla.
Well,
yes?
Yeah, I mean...
That in your imagination is continually, slipping in some ways.
Well, in some form, in order to understand what was happening in that melody, I mean, it might be that melody, it might in another piece be just two notes, but in order to understand what that implications of that are, it's almost like a person looking for their meaning of their life, whatever. But you had to get to the end, so that's what I did.
The third movement of that piece, Extasio, which is a pun, seemed to me, on a drug of the mid-90s, ecstasy, that was used in a lot of clubbing, still is, of course, and that movement is in a way related to dance music quite clearly. That must have been a pre-compositional decision, was it, to work with those rhythms, that deliberate referent of dance music, taking the world of a nightclub and in a way doing something with it on an orchestral scale?
Again, that was what was necessary for the piece to be completed.
So it wasn't a pre-compositional decision?
I don't really know what you mean by pre-compositional.
It wasn't something you say, I want to use that idea in
absolutely
a piece?
Absolutely not, no. I didn't know until when I got to the end of the second movement, I didn't know what was going to happen next until it happened.
So where did the idea come from then?
I don't know. I just sat down and that was the next that was the next part of the piece.
But there was a poetic idea of escape, of...
Oh, yes. Well, it was this thing I'm saying about shunting between time and the now and the then and the future and what...
Okay, well, let's just hear that third movement. From the concert hall to the opera house, Addis spent the first few years of the new millennium working on his opera for the Royal Opera House, which he also conducted, The Tempest.